This is Digital Story Podcast number 1013, August 19th, 2025. Today's theme is 5 Tips for Tasty Food Shots on the Go. I'm Derek Story. I'm working on a review of the Stoke Boteigues Nomad Cooking System for the Digital Story. It's a compact electric kit that's super nimble and perfect for light camping photographers. As a result, I've been doing my fair share of food photography lately. I'll share some tips and tricks in the first segment of today's podcast. I hope you enjoy the show. All right, before I get to the tips themselves, you may be wondering about this cooking kit I was talking about, the Nomad cooking system. And I just thought it was really tantalizing when I first saw it for a number of reasons. Now, there'll be a full review on it coming up on the Digital Story here in another week or so. But just so you know what I'm talking about when I'm talking about doing the food shots, it's an electric system that you can adjust from a low of 200 watts to a high of 1,000 watts in 200 watt increments. So you can go 200, 400, 600, 800, and 1,000 watts. Obviously, the higher you go wattage-wise, the hotter the pan is or the pot is, depending on what you're using. And it comes with what they call a sizzle pan, which is basically a high-edge skillet. And so that way you can get lots of food in there. And it's particularly good for vegetables when you're sauteing vegetables because, you know, they're really kind of piled when you first put them in there. Then as they cook, you know, they reduce in size. But I've used it for everything. I use it for breakfast, you know, so for eggs and things like that. I've used it for evening meals. On the latest camping trip that I just got back from, I marinated a pork chop. And then after the marinade time had run its course, I put it in the sizzle pan and cooked it, and it was delicious. And you know how it is, especially when you're camping. I've been, you know, documenting all of this for the review that I'm going to be doing, all these different dishes, not to mention the test dishes that I was doing in the kitchen at the Digital Story, because, you know, you don't want to wait till you're out in the middle of nowhere to see if this is going to work or not. So I did a lot of test cooking prior to the camping trip. And one of the things that just jumped out at me right away about this Nomad cooking system, because it's electricity, suddenly wind is not a factor in your cooking at all. And we all know how troublesome wind can be. And I tend to camp in coastal areas a lot, so wind is very common, almost constant for me. And how it, you know, it changes the heat, it blows off to the side, you know, it just creates all sorts of cooking problems in terms of just getting a constant heat on whatever you want. With the electric system, it's kind of like an induction system, the way it behaves. And so it can be, you know, 30 mile an hour winds. It makes no difference on your cooking, right? Because, you know, the heat is constant. You set it. The little timer tells you how long the system's been running. You have a lid for it, of course. You know, so it's really amazing. And I just found that cooking was so much easier using this electric system than trying to cook with flame. So that's what I used. I used that for the entire trip. And, you know, as you know, I carry batteries with me, Jackery and Blue Eddy batteries. So I had enough battery juice, even had some sunshine, so I could recharge the batteries or at least add a little bit, top off to them during the day. And everything worked out fine. So I've been doing product photography and food-related photography for a long time. There have been times when, you know, that's been one of my main gigs. I find product photography very difficult in the sense that it's hard for me to stay interested. It's extremely detailed-oriented and can be very tedious depending on, you know, how many things you have to shoot and how long the days are and all that kind of stuff. Food photography I like a little bit better, mainly because it's food. Just find it more interesting. And over the years, I've just come across some basic principles that I use for my food photography, which is never done in the studio. I don't take my food pictures in the studio. They're almost always on the go because, well, that's a lot of times when I'm, you know, need to take pictures of the stuff. And so these tips, I thought, work out really great, you know, for people who don't want to set up a whole studio, but every now and then want to, even if it's something as simple as taking a picture of an elegant dinner plate, you know, that's served to you in a restaurant, whatever it happens to be. But food is such a big part of our life that a lot of times it plays a role in our activities, and especially social activities, and then also camping and things like that. So it's nice to be able to record artistically these meals or, you know, these preparations and have them be part of the story as they really are. And so that's the angle that I'm taking on this. And we're going to start out with lighting, because of course lighting is so important in any kind of photography. And for food photography, I'm very much into even diffused lighting. I have tried so many different lighting setups over the years, especially when I was working in the studio. And I just found that, you know, a nice soft light source, whether you're working in the shade or you have, you know, a northern light source coming in through a window or, you know, outdoors, maybe through some diffused trees or something, or any place. You could be under an umbrella, for that matter. Diffused lighting, it just makes food look better. Spectral highlights tend not to look very good, at least to my eye, in food photography. You know, having a lot of contrast tends not to look very good to me in food photography. Having more even tones and textures, because food itself is so interesting, you don't need to do stuff with the lighting. You just really need not to mess it up, is the bottom line for me. Diffuse lighting works really well. Now, sometimes, depending on what you're trying to accomplish or the environment that you're in, you may want to add a little lighting to the background or take advantage of lighting that's there. And that sometimes can be a little bit more contrasty, a little slash lighting coming in, things like that. Just remember, you don't want it to detract from your main subject, which is the food itself. The safest way to go is diffuse lighting in shade if you need to. It's nice to, if it has a little pop to it, but just stay away from those spectral highlights and those really deep shadows. The second point I want to talk about is composition. And, you know, I think our initial instinct on food photography is to crop, you know, as tight as possible, you know, just like get right in there. But as I've looked at my food photography over the years, a lot of times my favorite shots are shots where the food is also incorporated into a pretty environment, a really nice kitchen or an excellent dining room or a really fabulous looking camping setup, you know, whatever it happens to be. And I think the context of the environment really does add to the shot. And you're going, oh, okay, so, you know, this is a very elegant meal in a very elegant setting. This is a more rustic meal in a very rustic setting. And it all kind of works together. Definitely compose the shot so that the food is the star of the show. But I really like to have a little contributing visual information around it. And I just almost enjoy that part of it as much as I do the food itself, because then when I look at the shot and I have the context of that meal that I'm preparing, I go, oh yeah, that was, oh yeah. And even on a personal level, I go, oh, that was a great camping trip. I had such a good time. I cannot believe how good that entree turned out, you know. And I did it in the middle of nowhere, or on a picnic table, or, you know, however it works out. By the way, along those lines, when I am outdoors, when I am camping, I do bring colorful placemats. I bring a runner for the picnic table. I bring things that are visually attractive, not just for the food photography. I mean, in part for the food photography, but also I just think it's more enjoyable, you know, to have a visually attractive setting to enjoy the meal or share it with other folks. I guess that's why we're photographers, right? So anyway, I think the bottom line on composition is, yes, it's good to get some tight shots, but maybe not every shot so tight that you miss out on maybe some of the nice contributing elements. White balance is the next one. And the next two points are about color, but in different ways. The first is white balance. A lot of times, because you are working with diffused light, shooting in shade or, you know, things like that, the light gets very bluish in those conditions. And even a lot of times the light through a north window can be fairly bluish, which isn't really good for food photography. I tend to think that most items look better with the warmer tones than with the cooler tones. They just look more alive, more appealing with the warmer tones. And I don't mean going warm. I just mean warm in terms of attractive, like a nice light jacket on a cool summer evening, that kind of thing. I tend to almost always adjust the white balance in post. I prefer to do it in post than while I'm trying to take the shot. And when I say post, it could be a picture that you took with your iPhone, and then you just spend a minute or two editing it before you send it off to wherever it's going to go. It doesn't take that long, and it's so easy to do in Photos. And in fact, Photos has a slider, a warm, cool slider, that just works fantastic for this very thing. And I have found that when I do pay attention to the white balance and I do make an adjustment before I send the photo off, I notice such a difference in the appeal of the shot that warming up the white balance just a bit to compensate probably for the cooler light temperature that you captured the image in just works wonders with the shot. The other color aspect that I want to talk about is bold colors, and this is completely different than white balance, although it does work in tandem with it. But things like red utensils, colorful placemats, attractive plates, things like that, you're going to be eating off something anyway. Why not have it be pretty? It doesn't cost any more to have, you know, a red stirrer than it does a black one, right? Now, I do prefer silicone for all my cooking utensils, just because I think it's a safer way to cook. But I get color in there wherever I can. And I just, a lot of times when I'm in Target or wherever I happen to be, and I wander through the kitchen section, and I'll go, wow, KitchenAid just like has this cool set that has a like a stirring spoon and a semi spatula, and there's a beautiful red with like a silver handle, you know, and a little loop on the end to hang them. I go, that is fantastic. And it's, you know, whatever, $10 or so for the set. Well, those types of utensils and accessories really change the shot when you just have those in your food shots. Remember, again, I'm backing away a bit more. And so, you know, I like having some of these items in there. Also, nice colors, as I talked about before, with the placemats, with a table runner for the picnic bench. You know, the picnic benches, if you're camping, are usually this kind of this dull gray color, maybe gray-brown sort of color. Just really not very appealing. And, you know, they may have some texture to them, but a lot of times they just may be beat up. And I think putting something over them, and I just have them in my cook kit. You know, I just have these simple, they don't take up very much room, the placemats and the runner and all that. Don't take up very much room at all. And then, of course, the utensils themselves. What a difference. I mean, what a difference having these splashes of color well placed in your composition really add a lot to the shots. And then finally, the last point, and boy, did I learn this painfully over the years when I was doing product photography, and that is details matter. Details really matter in still life photography, and essentially food photography is a form of still life photography. And, you know, in everyday life, you may not pay attention to how the handle is turned away, turned at an angle, or, you know, whatever it is. You may not pay attention to the labels for, you know, say, the spices that you use, the seasonings that you use for your meal, that they're turned towards you and not cockeyed, or that you don't have a lid partially open. You don't have very unattractive crumbs on the table. You get the picture, so to speak. I do two things to help with this details matter aspect. One is, I usually will clear away a number of items before I take the food shot, just distracting things. It could be silverware that is catching a light and that it's just overly bright that would be very difficult to fix in post. And like, why have it there if it's not necessary? Just take it out of the picture. Things that you just really aren't contributing to the shot. I have found that I can clear away the things that I don't want in the shot, take the picture, and then put them back all within, you know, a minute or two. This doesn't take much time. Then just visually look at all the details in the shot. Make sure that the labels are turned the way you want and all that. And a lot of times just having the camera angle right so that if there are things in the background, they're positioned in an attractive way that works with the whole shot. So it's just this thing of just taking a breath to take a look at your shot before you take it. Now, if you're just doing the simplest of food shots, let's say have your iPhone hovering over the plate of food, these things still come into play because chances are you're going to show the plate and that's going to show some table and all that. And even then, a couple distracting elements can, you know, really kind of wreck your shot. So those details really matter. Pay close attention to them. And I think you'll find that it makes a big difference. And then afterwards, you're not going, I got to get rid of that, or I got to cut that out of there, whatever. So the five things: lighting, composition, white balance, bold colors, and details matter. None of these things take very long. You still be able to get your shots quickly, whether they're with your iPhone or your mirrorless camera, whatever you happen to be using. And they make a big difference in the attractiveness of your photos. Let's take a look at some camera industry news. There's a lot of fascinating stuff going on right now. I think I'm going to start out with the story on DP Review. Update: Kodak says it has no plans to cease operations. And of course, there's a link in the show notes. Eastman Kodak warned investors on Monday that there is substantial doubt it will be able to continue to operate. The news came in the company's second quarter earnings report, as CNN reports. Kodak has subsequently contacted us to say that the statement of uncertainty over its future stems from rules surrounding financial reporting. It says it expects to be able to repay its obligations with funds it can't report as certain, so it had to make a going concern statement. Kodak currently has roughly $500 million in debt that is due within the next 12 months. The company ended the quarter with a cash balance of $155 million. It also reported a 1% year-over-year decrease in revenue and a GAAP net loss of $26 million for the quarter. Kodak added that these losses were primarily due to weak sales and higher costs. Kodak's executive chairman and CEO says that tariffs did not have a material impact on its business in Q2 because it is committed to U.S. manufacturing and makes a range of its products in the United States. However, the company added that it is addressing the potential impact of new tariffs moving forward. While Kodak warned about its financial status, it explained that its plan to reduce debt is moving forward. The termination of our U.S. Kodak retirement income plan and subsequent reversion of excess funds to pay down the debt is progressing as planned, said David Bullwinkle, Kodak CFO. It added that these plans are not solely within Kodak's controls and therefore are not deemed probable under U.S. GAAP accounting rules, which raises substantial doubt about the company's ability to continue as a going concern. Despite that, Bullwinkle says the company will continue to focus on reducing costs today and converting our investments into long-term growth. Finally here, I'll just close with this. There's more information in this article if you want to research it for yourself. A spokesperson for Kodak reached out to DP Review after this article was published with the following statement. Quote, "The going concern language in Kodak's 10Q is essentially required disclosure because Kodak debt comes due within 12 months of the filing. Kodak is confident that it'll be able to pay off a significant portion of its term loan well before it becomes due and amend, extend, or refinance our remaining debt and/or preferred stock obligations." So that's interesting that how this story sort of evolved, isn't it? Because I think a number of news publications really jumped on this, you know, Kodak's going to go out of business, going to cease operations. And, you know, they still may, right? We don't know one way or another. But that was based upon, according to Kodak anyway, of them having to report their finances in a certain way, you know, in accordance with the rules. Kodak is saying, we have a plan. Unfortunately, that plan doesn't, you know, play into the rules that we have to play by here. So it's the odds of things being okay are excellent. We'll see how this all pans out. But it's possible that maybe some people pushed the red warning button just a little bit early on this story. A little more financial news. There's a lot going on in that category, as you can imagine right now. Fujifilm is raising the prices of its cameras again. So this is the second raise that's just been announced. This article's on The Verge, and there's a link in the show notes. Just 2 weeks after raising the prices of its cameras by up to $800, Fujifilm is warning customers about another increase for U.S. customers. In a statement provided to DP Review, the Japanese company said it will further adjust prices as it contends with volatile market conditions. The change will go into effect on August 30th, but there still aren't many details about the specifics, including how many cameras or lenses it will affect and how much prices will increase by. Fujifilm tells DP Review that the price hike won't impact the newly released X-Half and XE5, which are priced at $850 and $1,699 respectively. Last month, President Donald Trump reached a trade deal with Japan that will subject imports from the country to a 15% tariff. As we navigate the current situation, Fujifilm is doing all we can to work with our retailers and consumers to weather the storm together, a company's statement says. Well, they must have done the math the first time and it just didn't work out, right? Because, so I think that the prices for the XE5 and the X-Half already reflect, you know, these increases that are going to be applied to the other cameras. And so those are built in already. And that could be part of the reason why when people looked at the X-Half, they go, ooh, $850 seems a little steep for that camera. Well, I think now we have another clue as to what may contribute to that. I'm sure more will be revealed as we get closer to August 30th about the second rounds of tariffs. I would think, however, that if you were planning on making a Fujifilm purchase anyway, you might want to consider doing it before the second round of increases hit. They could be substantial. Speaking of Fujifilm, here's an article on Petapixel. Fujifilm X-Half is yet again the best-selling camera in Japan by a lot. Now, do you find that interesting at all? I published a preliminary review of the X-Half on LiveView on our medium.com site. People are going, it costs too much. It doesn't shoot raw. They're just like not high on it at all. Yet in Japan, this thing is selling like hotcakes. Let's see what Petapixel has to say here. The Fujifilm X-Half compact camera remains the best-selling camera in Japan for a second consecutive month. Anyone who thought that the Fujifilm X-Half initial popularity in Japan was destined to be a short-lived flash in the pan, a bunch of launch week hype, will be surprised to find that the X-Half not only remains the best-selling camera at MAP Camera in Japan, but is overwhelmingly ahead of the second best-selling camera, the Sony A7 Mark II, as spotted by Digicam Info. MAP Camera notes that the three models of the X-Half, the charcoal gray version, is by far the most popular. The Japanese retailer received more pre-orders for the charcoal model than the black and silver versions combined. The company still cannot fulfill its order for the charcoal X-Half, so some photographers have switched to the black and silver versions, which are more readily available. MAP's list of top 10 best-selling new cameras for July 2025 is impressively diverse. Fujifilm has the most cameras on the list again, with the X-M5, the X-S20, and the X-T5 cracking the list in 5th, 6th, and a tie for 10th position. However, 6 different companies made the list. Fujifilm, of course, Sony, Nikon, Ricoh, OM System, and Canon. The Ricoh GR3X in 4th place is quite interesting. Ricoh announced in May that a GR4 will arrive this fall, which could explain a dip in demand for the standard GR3, but consistent interest in the GR3X with its longer built-in lens. Ricoh has not yet commented on the possibility of a GR4X, although it has said that the GR4 HDF is in the works. OM System is making the list in 7th place with the OM5 Mark II, which is notable. OM System has struggled in terms of mainstream appeal, but the company hopes that the OM5 II's stylish compact design will appeal to modern photographers, and so far, so good. Sony and Nikon are the heavy hitters in the latest used camera sales rankings. In July, the Nikon ZF was MAP Camera's best-selling used camera, followed by the Ricoh GR3X, the Sony A7 III, the Fujifilm X-T5, the Ricoh GR3, the Nikon Z50 Mark II, the Sony A7C Mark II, the Nikon ZFC, the Sony A7 IV, and for all the DSLR holdouts, the Nikon D750. This is the second month in a row that the Nikon ZF has been MAP Camera's most popular used camera model. I think it's so fascinating that when we look at a new camera and we initially rule it out for whatever purpose, and I do the same thing, I'm talking about me as well. It doesn't have this, so there's no way I'm going to be interested in it. It doesn't have that, well, that's not for me. You know, that kind of thing. I think for me, one of those things is a tilting LCD. If it doesn't have that, I'm not really interested in it anymore. But the whole world doesn't think the way that we do. And that is really sobering sometimes. I think this story about the Fujifilm X-Half, which I would guess a lot of people here in the States thought it was destined to be a flop. Well, I guess that depends on where you are. Just one more quick story here. It just caught my eye on f-stoppers. Lightroom sliders you're probably using wrong. And I have a link to this in the show notes, and you're going to want that link because it shows a video that discusses what I'm going to be talking about right here. Lightroom is full of small controls that can quietly ruin your images if you don't understand how they interact. The difference between an artificial edit and a clean natural one often comes down to how you balance the simplest tools. When you know which sliders are tricking you you can stop fighting the program and start getting the results that feel intentional. It starts with exposure and contrast, which sounds simple but actually pull against each other in unexpected ways. Push exposure up and you'll notice the image loses contrast and saturation even though those sliders haven't been touched. Lower the exposure and suddenly both contrast and color deepen. The point here is that these two controls aren't independent. They are meant to be adjusted together if you want your photo to stay balanced. Needham, the author of the video, even shows how he jailbroke Lightroom with a preset trick to lift or lower both at once, something the program doesn't allow by default. This alone can save you from the common problem of images that feel washed out or overly crunchy. The video then moves on to the texture, clarity, and dehaze sliders, which carry more subtlety than their names suggest. Use clarity too aggressively and you end up with a harsh clinical feel. Drop it and the frame melts into something soft and dreamy, almost like a lens smeared with Vaseline. By balancing negative clarity with positive texture, Needham shows you how you can mimic the gentle rendering of vintage lenses while keeping important micro contrast intact. The demonstration makes it clear how much character you can add or subtract depending on how these tools are combined. And I just love this. I think he's really onto something here. This is one of the reasons why I like the Orton effect as well, which is, you know, kind of in the same vein as this. But this section of the video is really good. Another interesting point comes when he uses the dehaze slider, not to fix atmospheric haze, but to reveal dust on the sensor. Pushing it to the extreme brings every spot forward, making cleanup far easier before you print. Tricks like this are reminders that Lightroom's tools often do more than what the labels imply. Small shifts in how you approach them can make the difference between an edit that looks natural and one that screams overprocessed. Check out the video above for the full rundown from Needham. Yes, this is good stuff. Some really good stuff. And one of the things that I like so much about Lightroom, and I talk about this in our physical workshops especially, is that for the sliders, the mark starts in the middle of the slider. So for instance, with clarity, you can either add clarity or subtract clarity. I find myself subtracting clarity maybe as third often as I'm adding it. So, which is, you know, quite a bit, because we always think of clarity going one way, going to the right, not to the left. And so I think Lightroom is, you know, built nicely for that. And I think this video, if you're interested in this, is worth your time to watch. Let's take care of a little virtual camera club news. First, I want to start off by welcoming our new Inner Circle Bold members. We have some folks sign up this past week. We're so happy to have you here. This is such an exciting group of photographers and artists. A lot of them well-versed in the history of the digital story community and also well-versed in all things photography. And when you hang around a group like that and you just listen to them comment on each other's thoughts or pictures, you learn so much. You just pick it up by osmosis. And then you can ask your own questions and get direct answers to whatever you're interested in. And this all happens on our space on Derek Story Online, dedicated strictly for Inner Circle members. If you want to join this group, hang out with these fantastic people on your computer, on your smartphone app, you know, there's many ways to use our Mighty Network site. Then all you have to do is click on the Patreon tile that's on all the pages of the Digital Story, nose around a bit, sign up, and then next thing you know, you'll be getting an email from me with access to our space and letting you know about other goodies that you have coming to you. A big thanks to our Inner Circle and Inner Circle Bold members. If you're itching to get out there and do a little physical photography with your comrades, I want to remind you that we have two workshops with spots open. both the Route 66 Photography Workshop in October 14 through 17 and the Sonoma County Autumn Adventure Workshop on November 4th. Both of those workshops have complete descriptions on our site. So all you have to do is click on workshops either on Digital Story or Nimble Photographer. Take a look at them. There's still time to grab that last seat and join us. Both of these events are going to be a lot of fun and you come away with excellent pictures. And finally, I'd like to thank our friends at Red River Paper, longest running sponsor of the Digital Story. I noticed that one of the things that talked about in the Lightroom video I was discussing earlier is, you know, pumping up the dehaze to find sensor dust so that you can eliminate it. And he said, before you print. Isn't that cool? Before you print. Yes. Yeah, so, you know, by doing that simple technique and reviewing your image, you're going to save yourself a sheet of paper and the ink that goes on that paper. And boy, that adds up over time. Those little pre-press tricks are really cool. There's a lot of that kind of information on the Red River Paper site. And we have a tile on all the pages of the Digital Story. You can just click on it and go over there, get some paper, read a few articles, you know, learn a little bit about printing for your particular passion, whether it be portrait or landscape, whatever type of photography you like, urban. And then get to work and make some beautiful images that you can hand to people, that you can put on the wall, that you can make fine art cards with. Truly creating art from end to end. And a big thanks to Red River Paper for supporting this podcast. All right, it's going to do it for me this week. I hope you enjoyed the show. Working on more cool stuff for next week. Until then, get out there, take some pictures, stay safe. See you next Tuesday. Bye-bye now.